The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. It's coming home. England's women beat Scotland in the World Cup in Nice, while England's men exorcise the demons of the third place playoff in Russia as Jordan Pickford ghosts all Kevin Pressman in the Nations League, where later on Portugal win the whole thing. Elsewhere in France, the hosts demolish South Korea, while the biggest upset sees Australia lose to Italy. There are wins for Scotland and Northern Ireland in the Euro qualifiers, while the Irish draw in Denmark and Wales lose in Croatia. We'll also discuss Hazard, Sarri, Sessegnon and Wan-Bissaka. Take your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, a question from Adam for Jonathan Wilson. Will Jonathan ever be able to bowl a wrong un again? You've fresh out of surgery, Jonathan. You've got a marvellous... Well, tell us about the sling. You're very proud of it, aren't you?
Well, it's an Ultra Sling 3. It's top of the range. It's got its attached stress ball.
It literally has in a Velcro its own little holster for a stress ball that you can squeeze through the day.
To strengthen the forearm.
Okay. What's the sling called again?
The sling is an Ultra Sling 3.
Okay. And as Lars asked before the show, is the Ultra Sling 2?
I just wasn't interested in anything that wasn't top of the range.
Fine.
I mean, to be honest, I woke up and they stuck it on us, and I didn't really... Okay. So the thing, you've got no agency when you're having an operation. Okay. You're literally unconscious.
Here's a question from Jonathan for Lars. Siverton, older or younger than 40?
Younger by a margin.
Well, we'll get there in the end. Keep firing the questions in. Mark Langdon from the Racing Post, welcome.
Hi, Max.
Let's start then with the Women's World Cup and bring in our women's football correspondent, Susie Rack. Susie, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Very good. Where do we find you?
By the side of a road, somewhere on the outskirts of Nice.
All right. What are you doing there? You're hitching a lift? Are the Guardian not stretched to taxis?
No, I've got a hire car. I'm on the way to Montpellier for Canada v Cameroon later on today.
All right. Well, let's start with England's win over Scotland. Very much a game of two halves, Susie, wasn't it?
Yeah, completely. I mean, Scotland had a fairly decent start to the game, by all accounts. The first 10 minutes in particular were quite good, but then England completely took over and controlled that first half. I think the problem was Scotland set up really defensively, which was probably paying a little bit too much time to too much attention to England. So, you know, they've got some really great attacking talent. Kim Little in the middle, Erin Cuthbert up front, Lisa Evans on the wing. That's a brilliant little forward line they've got, but they stuck five in the middle. They sat really deep. Kim Little couldn't get out of her own half for most of the game, and so you left Erin Cuthbert really isolated up front, and that was where their problem started, is that they paid too much attention to trying to keep out England rather than to actually playing their game, really.
How impressed are you with Lucy Bronze and Nikita Paris?
They're both absolutely excellent in that game. I think Leon can be very excited about the kind of partnership they've got. Paris and Bronze both said after the game that they really click. Paris said she's not played with a better right back behind her when they were at Manchester City together. Now with England, and you know, with Leon going forward, like it's a really exciting pairing. The only problem is that was England by far best area of the pitch. That any team watching it is going to look at it and say, right, we shut them off and we shut off England.
And is it that simple? I mean, why can't England, you know, why don't they have other places where they can impose themselves on the opposition?
I think Lucy Bronze has been so important to Neville, and he's said repeatedly that he thinks she's the best player in the world. So he's putting a lot kind of through her, getting the ball through her. Beth Mead looked a little bit lost kind of over on the other wing, out on the left, and I think that might be partly because she had Alex Greenwood behind her, who's been playing in the Championship all season. You know, she's not used to this, she's not played at the kind of top level for a year, so it, you know, that probably cut her off a little bit. Didn't necessarily have the best game, Alex Greenwood, but if they can utilise Beth a little bit more, then they have got other things in their locker, but it's just so clear that Lucy Bronze and Nikita Paris are world class, yeah. Whereas the rest of the team aren't quite there yet.
There was one turn from Nikita Paris where she sort of
Lars, you're nodding your head. She sort of flicked the ball through a defender's leg, which was just beautiful, wasn't it?
Yeah, just really excellent and exciting to watch, and that's the good news, I guess. The thing that would concern me watching this game a bit is the extent to which England just kind of lost control of it in the second half. Like, when you're 2-0 up and you are a team who look to keep possession, who want to be confident on the ball, want to control the game, Scotland really getting at them in a way that doesn't bode very well with regards to future opponents, I guess.
Tougher opponents will cause them a lot more trouble. We've seen that in the kind of recent games, New Zealand one, the Canada one, where they conceded. The defence isn't great at set pieces, doesn't look very organised, which is surprising when, you know, you think Neville should be fairly decent at setting up a defence. They have struggled a little bit, but at the same time they've won, so, you know, that's all that matters at the moment, really, isn't it?
I don't want to bang on about VAR this early, Mark, but I know that's a handball, and there was another one in the Brazil game, but it's so frustrating.
And what annoys me is that, you know, there were a lot of people that were demanding consistency, and actually, I think in bringing in this rule, it will make things more consistent, in that you are going to see just basically all handballs, or nearly all handballs, just given as penalties, but clearly they're not, and I think that Scotland have a right to be aggrieved at that penalty decision, as was the one in the Brazil game. There's just nowhere really for the hand to go at that point, and it's so close. You will get, whether Mane did it against Sissoko, I'm not sure, but you will get players now aiming to hit the hand. I mean, and it makes sense to do that, I think.
Susie, lots of empty seats there, 13,000 people in the stadium. I've heard people saying that's really good, and I've heard people saying that's really bad. Which is it?
It's mixed, because for me it was bad, because it had been picked up as a sellout. And what the FA had done is they had, you know, tweeted, "Oh, we've sold out, blah, blah, blah." They sold out their allocation, which was really small, like 1,500 tickets or something. And so everyone was expecting a big crowd. They didn't even open up here. But there was Louise was having a chat with some of the locals, and they were saying that they were really frustrated that you couldn't buy tickets on the door, that it had to be done through the FIFA website, it had to be done through Visa, and that there isn't really a culture of that here. There's very much a culture of rocking up to the Stade de Nice and paying on the gate, and with security schemes here quite high, that was, you know, like quite a frustration of the locals. So you didn't get as many people from Nice in the game, in the ground, as you would have liked. So it looked frustratingly empty. It's disappointing. I'd hope that there'll be the half game, because it's a bit close to home. The Japan game, obviously, because it's the final group game and is the toughest game of the group. So, you know, fingers crossed they're a little bit better, but it's, you know, clearly going to be fairly low attendances across the board, given that it's about a million tickets sold for 52 games.
How much confidence can Scotland take from that second half performance?
Loads. They've got a really good chance of getting out of this group, because the best third place finishers, the four best third place finishers, get through to knockouts. So if they can get a result against Argentina, which they should be able to do, you know, Argentina are a very weak side. They're an advantage being in a group of four where there is a really weak team. So if they get a decent result and get a decent goal margin in that, then they've got a chance. The second half against England will give them confidence against Japan as well. Japan are a great team, but the key is they've got to start playing to their strengths. They've got to not worry about the defence so much, and they've got to come out and try and get a goal, because that's their strength. They've got, like, so much creativity in the middle through Kim Little. They've got to get her on the ball, and that was where they really, really struggled until the second half, when they pushed her up a little bit more. They got Lisa Evans with her forward. That was when they started creating a little bit better.
Biggest upset was Australia's defeat to Italy. I watched this in a hotel in Porto with an Australian man who was very disappointed at basically Australia gifting Italy two goals, Susie.
Yeah, I mean, Australia are an interesting team, because they've got massive, massive potential. Sam Kerr is one of the best strikers in the world. But defensively, they're absolutely shambolic. And, I mean, they had the two warnings of the goals, the two Italy goals ruled out for offside early on. You know, they knew that Bonafia was a threat. But yet they still kind of almost just ignored it and let Italy kind of find the space in behind them. And that's the biggest problem they're going to have is they've got a load of creative talent up front, but they're just a big mess at the back.
Hmm. It seemed like a ball at the top always caused them problems, but Italy were 4-1 to win this game. I mean, that they are long odds. How big an upset is this?
Yes, a big upset in terms of Italy not having been in a World Cup for 20 years, but less if you follow it quite closely, they've actually got quite a good team, and I would have picked them as dark horses to escape the group at the start of the tournament. So I'm not too surprised that they got a result. I thought they would do better against the other teams. I wasn't necessarily expecting such a good result to come from the Australia game itself, but the Italian league is growing massively, and their players kind of getting professional contracts within the past few years at the likes of Juventus and Fiorentina and things like that. And their league is on the up, and that's reflected in their national team more and more. So it is a surprise. It is a big upset. Australia are by far a superior team, higher ranked, etc. But the Italians have this kind of flair and defensive stability through the league going professional that they've not had before.
Germany beat China 1-0. 19 fouls by the Chinese team. Are they the shithouses of this World Cup, Susie?
That's impressive. I didn't know that stat. I thought the Chinese were pretty poor, actually. I was a little bit disappointed in them. They were kind of my dark horse pick for the whole tournament because they've kind of got the best record in the friendlies to run up to this, 13 games unbeaten in a row. Kind of had been plugging away in the background a little bit. But China should have 2 goals in the first half, Yang Li, 2 really, really great chances. But I suppose that's German football for you. They've got the ability to get the result even when their backs are against the wall. And I don't know if you saw the awful Bild cover. I don't know how it got through their editors, because it's the 19-year-old Julia Gwynn that scored, and their cover said ugly football scored by but a goal from a beautiful player.
Gosh.
Or the most beautiful player, which I thought was particularly sickening.
It's just amazing that I don't know, I'm just so surprised. You're right, you can see somebody having that idea, and then someone then in the office going, no, you can't do that. So you wonder how many people it's got to get
19.
Through. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, she's 19. What does that say about the other players on the team? And how the hell did that get through?
Yeah.
This whole series of editors is absolutely beyond me.
Spain came from behind to beat South Africa. 2 penalties from Jennifer Hermoso and 1 a goal from Lucia Garcia. How good are Spain, Susie? They were 8-1 on to win this game.
Yeah, similar. Oh, I mean, those odds are more about how, kind of weak South Africa are than how good Spain are. Spain are a decent team, but they're kind of a bit mid-ranking in the Spanish football, very much like Italian football, is going through its renaissance at the moment domestically. So, you're only now seeing the Barcelonas and some of the other clubs in the Spanish league start investing. Real Madrid still haven't got a team. Atletico, the team to beat. So it's still very much early days in terms of getting that filtering through into the national team. But they are a decent side, and it should have been a routine win for them. That they fell behind was the shock. It's their front players that are the key, not the Vicky Lasada and Hermoso and Garcia kind of being the key front players defensively. They're up to much.
Susie, thanks so much for coming on. Enjoy your time in that lay-by. I hope you get a lift at some point.
Cheers.
Susie Rack there, the Guardian's women's football correspondent. Lars, you were about to say something.
Well, I've watched all of these games now, and my big hot take from the World Cup so far is that with the new laws imposed by IFAB, the game has gotten very, very difficult for defenders who have arms attached to their bodies I mean, that seems to now be a significant handicap, because the handball rule, as it is now, handball law, if you will, is completely out of control. The penalty against Jamaica for Brazil is one of the dumbest things I've ever seen.
I mean, that was much worse than England.
It was much, much worse. The England one, like, you see them given. I personally don't think they should, because how is the Scottish player meant to move her body without having her arm out a little bit?
But agree with that.
But it stops the cross. Fair enough. Do yourself a favor, if you haven't seen it, find the highlights. The penalty that was given against Jamaica is one of the dumbest things I've ever seen, because her hand is right by her side. I mean, that is proper sort of, you have to chop off your hand territory to not get called against. And the thing about VAR is, we can't say that, oh, the ref had a bad angle, he only saw it once. Like, they've looked at the video of this several times and said, yeah, this is what a penalty is now.
So surely this will change at some point. Surely eventually this will change, because
I was thinking about this, in the 1998 World Cup, Italy got a penalty against Chile with Roberto Baggio lifting the ball quite deliberately into a Chilean defender's arm. I mean, you know, he was basically standing up for the Chilean defender to the right side of the box, and he deliberately sort of flicked the ball into the hand as it sort of hung by the side of the body, and that was given as a penalty. Now, at some point after that World Cup, IFAB or FIFA must have said, this is not, we can't have this, that's not a penalty anymore, because nobody's done it since. And now players are starting to do it again. So they have to kind of have that, whatever reconsideration they had post-98, they've got to have again.
Is this come in because of VAR?
Well, I think the point is now we can just see them. Like previously, a ball struck from close range into a defender, the referee could go, it hit him, I couldn't see what it hit.
Yeah.
And now he's more sort of, partly VAR saying, I think you should have a look at that, and partly the ref saying, actually, I think I probably did hit the hand, and if it didn't, it's all right, because VAR will tell me it didn't, and we can give the drop ball or whatever.
Yeah, so the referee basically had leeway to just, let's just not give that before, but they don't anymore.
So the laws of football will hopefully change?
I think they have to, because I think, again, if that penalty that was given against Jamaica after a video check, so that's clearly how the rules are now meant to be interpreted. If that's a penalty, God help defenders everywhere. Like, what are you meant to do with your arms? And again, if I was a very smart and quick and clever and technically gifted Premier League forward, I'd go into next season absolutely with a plan of flicking it into people's arms every time I'm in the box.
Even if you're not particularly gifted, if you've got no options on, just ping the ball across the chest height and it might hit somebody's arm.
I mean, Mick McCarthy was asked about this before the game against Denmark on Friday, and he said he would instruct his players to start doing that in quite that sort of...
But Ireland are the best at scoring goals, so it's like a...
No, but they, you know, it's a good way of scoring goals. And he said, well, everybody else will be doing it, so we're going to join in. I just wonder whether the lawmakers and UEFA and FIFA, this actually kind of plays to what they want in terms of goals. You know, if you can get a higher scoring tournament.
But it becomes a very kind of
higher scoring through penalties. I mean, that's not fun.
Yeah, very frustrating technical game. I mean, you made...
Like hockey.
Yeah, you made the comparison to hockey, which I don't think is entirely fair. But in terms of the foot law, yeah.
Hmm. And, I mean, this whole thing, you shouldn't complain about something without offering a solution. I increasingly think that maybe it's worth looking into handballs in the area that are clearly no intent at all and that don't stop an obvious goal or obvious goal opportunity. Could be like an indirect free kick or something.
Fine.
Because the thing about penalties is that it's basically a 70% chance of scoring or more, right? So it's a completely disproportionate punishment.
Which is where it's different in hockey, because you're giving a short corner rather than a penalty flick unless it's actually stopping a goal. Yeah. But I think we had it right in the Premier League the season before last, where you really had to go out your way to handle the ball to get it called against you. Just have a world adopt that.
France beat South Korea 4-0 in the opening game, and France were... I mean, it was like a football team against... It was such a mismatch.
That was a really worrying... I sort of was watching that, and part of me was sort of thinking France were really good here, and part of me was thinking, this isn't great for the tournament. Because it was so easy that first half, and Renard was like a foot taller than Wang, the Korean who was marking her, and just looked like any time you got any kind of service in the box, she was going to score. But, I mean, to be fair to South Korea, they tightened up second half. I think maybe they're a little bit overawed.
I think France did look quite special, though.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is how similar they are to the men's team. You know, they've apparently had this problem of turning domination possession into goals, though they have now scored in 21 of the last 23 internationals. But that's been the criticism of them. But they are sort of a big physical side who are also technically gifted. And they also appear to have Gauvin, a classic French World Cup winning centre forward who will not score any goals.
massive fan of Wendy Renard, just not her, you know, being 6'2" and just a terrifying unit in the penalty area there. But like in her last eight seasons for Lyon, I looked this up, she scored a total of 84 goals in her last eight seasons. Yes. So she, for her club side, she averages more than double figures
every season.
Free kicks not really.
Up front, like,
a couple of penalties here and there, but by and large, she doesn't because they have so many gifted players. So if you think of goal scoring centre halves, like Sergio Ramos, if I'm not mistaken, has gotten into double figures twice in his entire career or something.
But does she ever go Paul Warhurst and go up front?
I'm not sure. Well, she should.
Lump it up to Renard.
Koeman and Passarella would be the two I'd go for goal scoring centre half.
Well, I've thought about Curran. I'm not sure they're that good. I'm not sure Koeman's that handy.
Used to get a few, didn't he?
Well, it's free kicks, isn't it? Yeah.
But just as someone who doesn't take penalties or set pieces regularly, as far as I could find out, to have a over double figure average goals for eight seasons in a row is unbelievable.
Norway beat Nigeria 3-0. Were you dancing in the streets of...
I mean, you say that, but it was a big deal because there's been so much noise about other stuff going into it. I think it was really important for the team to have a game where they showed everyone that actually we're here and we kind of matter as well. And Caroline Graham Hansen playing really, really well is important. She's a very leading figure there. Guro Reiten, who's been great for her club side but struggled a little bit internationally or had not been as good internationally, are getting a goal and looking very good. I mean, it's a really good start, I think.
First half were pretty poor. I mean, Nigeria, I thought first half were pretty poor. They've won 9 of 11 African Women's Cups of Nations, but there's obviously a huge leap between the African women's game and the global game. So they brought in Demeby, the Swedish coach, who supposedly has made them more defensively sound, but wasn't much evidence of that.
No, I mean, there are a few mismatches, right? And that will happen
in a developing form of the game.
Yeah,
you expect that. Yeah,
Brazil 3, Jamaica 0. A hat trick for Cristiano, including a brilliant free kick in off the bar. Disappointingly, it bounced back out again. It needed to go in off the bar and then hit the roof of the net to be a full Yeboah. Formiga is 41, playing in her 7th World Cup. They've only been 8 World Cups.
It's pretty extraordinary.
She's the only player who's played in every single Olympic since women's football was introduced to that as well. That is tremendous.
Well, my big takeaway from this game was that Brazil versus Australia should be great fun because, yeah, they won 3-0, but I thought they were occasionally quite ropey at the back, Brazil. Jamaica could have easily had one or two goals.
But the Jamaican keeper made two or three really good
saves. Yeah, no, she was great as well. So what I'm saying is them against the Matildas with their sort of bizarrely high line should be a tremendously fun game. I think with Jamaica, the goalkeeper, as you said, was really, really good. And Khadija Shaw looks about as good as she was talked up to be before the season. She moves around a lot, you know, hits the ball very cleanly. She's going to have a very good career.
Edward says, given the comparative lack of time wasting, shithousery and rolling around injured, do matches at this World Cup actually have more football played than men's games? Thinking back to that Burnley-West Brom game a few years ago with the ball in play for only 47 minutes. It's possible, isn't it?
Well, that's a very reductive idea of what football is. I mean, personally, I quite like time wasting, rolling about, shithousery. And I think the sooner the women's game can incorporate that, the better for everybody.
I did enjoy Lucy Bronze doing a classic bit of shithousery when Scotland got their goal and she was straight in the net to grab the ball and not give it back. I mean, that was high.
That is high a pure... That is, I mean, is that textbook? It's almost page one, isn't it?
Very, very good.
Some of the standout fixtures this week. Germany, Spain and France, Norway on Wednesday is a good day. The Netherlands, what are you worried about?
Don't think that's... I mean, as much as I was positive on our performance against Nigeria, like you say, Wilson, not great opposition. And they did actually let Nigeria have more chances than I would have hoped maybe. So against the French, I think that could be tricky.
Netherlands, Japan, Sweden and the US all get their campaigns underway as well. And on that, Hope Solo as a pundit is quite... formidable, isn't she? I mean, I was listening to her talk about the US manager who she'd played under for a long time, and she basically went, she's completely useless, buckles under pressure. If we win, anything. It's completely in spite of her.
It was just a tone of voice in which she said it as well, very sort of smiling and sort of chilled out, not like she was going to launch a sort of Sue-ness, Roy Keane-style full frontal assault. Like, the epitome of the smiling assassin from the punditry position, quite something.
Yeah, right, that'll do for part one. In part two, we'll discuss the Nations League, beginning with Jordan Pickford's penalty. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. England 0, Switzerland 0. England winning 6-5 on penalties. Should we start with Jordan Pickford's penalty. I mean, there was so much bend on that ball, Mark. I reckon without a net, it might have done a full circle.
It was impressive stuff from Pickford. He seems to own those penalty shootouts. I think it kind of suits his character. He's been accused of being sort of too confident maybe at times in the Premier League with Everton. But, you know, he certainly feels the goal sort of much more than Sommer did for Switzerland. And it was a great penalty.
Sommer almost sort of made himself as small as possible.
He did, yeah.
Because he's not a small man. I think Sommer's probably taller than Pickford, but... In terms of height of personality, if that's a thing.
Sounds like it.
Yeah, and you know, for England to have so many different penalty-taking options heading into the European Championships next summer, I think that can only be a good thing. I wasn't as downbeat on this third-place playoff as just about everybody else, actually. I mean, I feel like it had to be there. I mean, if you invite fans from all over, you know, to come to... You can't sort of send them home, I don't think, after one match. So I think you needed the second... sort of game, really. And also, I think if you sit for 120 minutes, you deserve a good penalty shootout, and we got that.
Yeah, I mean, arguably it could go straight to penalties after 90 minutes. Ryan says, Pickford or Pressman, who did it better? Well, obviously Kevin Pressman. There is no debate about that. The greatest penalty, I believe, of all time.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably true. I'd like to spin this with a Sunderland line, but Pickford's was a great penalty and a great save as well. But yeah, Pressman's was just there's no
saving that from Pressman.
Yeah, there's no risk about it either, because there's no curl on it. So it's just 3 inches into the bar, 3 inches inside the post.
It's just a goal kick. That's what it is. Trent Alexander-Arnold got a lot of praise.
What I also liked,
yes,
and I don't know if this was why he did it, but by taking his gloves off before he took the penalty, he then allowed himself to take ages putting them back on and psych out the. Was it Cher who took the next penalty? Who unfortunately wasn't psyched out, but I liked that. If that was his plan, I enjoyed that.
Yeah, I think it probably was. Trent Alexander-Arnold's got a lot of headlines, created more chances against Switzerland than any other England player has managed in total during the entire Nations League campaign. 7. And Lars, he is clearly the best right back. I think he's better than Kyle Walker at every bit of football. And I think Kyle Walker's a good player, and I guess Trippier still is in the mix for right back, but Trent Alexander-Arnold is something else, isn't he?
Yeah, his rise the last couple of years, or not even that long, has been absolutely amazing. And he doesn't look like a young player. Like when he plays, he plays like a guy who's like mid to late 20s. He seems to be like almost at the peak of his game already. And watching him appear, like you can almost say he's appearing consistently in Champions League finals, Max, which is pretty outlandish. No, amazing player.
The midfield was much better than against Holland. Now, I suppose Switzerland's midfield is not as good as Holland's, but they seem to play more of a diamond. I thought Dele Alli had a good game. Lots of people say he didn't, but I thought he got into a lot of good positions.
I think he had a good game yesterday. Yeah, people were saying he didn't.
Some people, yeah.
I mean, strange. Anyway, I mean, I guess whether you play the diamond or the three, partly is conditioned by the opposition. I mean, it just looked more like a first team yesterday than they played against the Netherlands. I don't think England was bad against the Netherlands as a lot of the fallout suggested, but equally, I thought the decision not to pick any Tottenham or Liverpool players was a bit weird. I mean, 5 days after the final, it doesn't matter how drunk you get, you kind of should be able to play in that. So, I thought England played very well, but pretty well, and should have won the game.
There was less pressure on the ball, wasn't there, really? So that did make it slightly easier, I suppose, really, to play through midfield.
Harry Maguire was excellent again as a complete cult hero amongst the England fans. Gomez played well alongside him. Do you see that as the central defensive partnership?
I would like to think so in terms of Gomez, but he needs to get into the Liverpool team first of all, because he's got a job on now, because Matip finished the season so well for Liverpool, and you've got Lovren in the mix as well. But yeah, I think so. But then, John Stones had that a nightmare game, I suppose, against the Dutch. But if he can get himself back into the Manchester City team as well, that just gives you really good options. I mean, going into the last few months, I felt that Stones and Gomez would actually be England's best partnership, but Maguire seems to revel in the role, I think, of playing.
He's better on the ball than he looks.
He is, and also I think he is getting better defensively. There were times I wondered about him just sort of dozing off a little bit, but I feel like he has improved there, and Leicester have got a job on, I suppose, to keep him in the summer, because you know, it already looks like sort of both Manchester clubs are interested, and I suppose he maybe needs to take if he could play Champions League regularly, that can only improve his game.
It's worth saying Switzerland were well below how they played against Portugal. I thought in the Portugal game it was Ronaldo was the difference. I actually thought, you know, Shaqiri had an excellent game.
Shaqiri going off reduced their threat significantly. The other thing, I mean, just something more generally about the Nations League, I think they've, assuming this is here to stay, they've got to work out the timing a bit better. You can't really, I mean, while I think Southgate should have played the Liverpool and Tottenham players, you can't really have a semi-final of a major tournament coming 5 days after Champions League final. Mm. So it's simultaneously too close to Champions League final and too long after the end of the season. So nobody's ready for it.
Yeah, I agree with you. I can't think where you put it. You just in an international break somewhere?
No, I think you have to just push it back a week. And okay, people might be a bit annoyed their holidays are delayed by a week, but at least give them a chance to play a friendly in that week to kind of actually get the players together, rather than turning up after, you know, after getting hammered on their bus through Liverpool and suddenly within 2 or 3 days being expected to adjust to...
True. I mean, I guess as it goes on in sort of 20, 30 years' time, if it's been a success and it becomes more important, that's possible that teams will give it even more importance and go, oh, that's fair enough, we'll prepare.
Yeah, I just think you can't really prepare if you've only got 5 days and at least one of them's going to be taken out by celebrations.
Yeah. Robbie says... don't you think that after Pirlo, Modric and De Jong, we should start trying to figure out how to stop these kind of players rather than desperately looking for our own? I'm thinking of Dele Alli on Jorginho in the Chelsea-Spurs games. Seems too easy to run the game against England. Lars, what do you think?
Well, you have Dele Alli there, so you could do a similar thing. But no, you're right. That is a side of it as well, for sure. But that doesn't mean it's not a problem that England doesn't have a midfielder who can control a game. I mean, that's also something that you should be worried about.
Could do both, I guess. Now, I was watching the Sky commentary, and I know we've talked about VAR already, but wow, Martin Tyler hates VAR, doesn't he? Quite fun to hear him.
He's quite pumped up for the whole tournament, actually, Martin Tyler. It was, he seemed to care about it sort of more than maybe even than Gareth Southgate and some of the England players. He did also throw out one very bizarre question where he asked if Trent Alexander-Arnold was sort of defensively capable enough to play international football. You're thinking, like, international football is below the standard that he plays at sort of most weeks.
And most of the opponents England will play are going to be weaker opponents who sit very deep, where actually the fullback's job is almost entirely to get forward and put crosses in.
I don't think VAR is going to get more sort of bad PR in social media than in this instance when you give a decision against England right at the end of a game, which means a bunch of journalists who are there and really don't want to be there have to be there for a bit longer. Mm. I mean, there's going to be some scorching takes on social media under any circumstances, whether the decision is right or not.
I mean, I think the decision is right, but again, it is... VAR is going to change the game, because that almost certainly would not have been given as a foul in the past, just because a referee wouldn't have been looking in that part of the box. And you then get an imbalance because essentially defenders can do that to forwards outside the box, because it's never going to get looked at. But as soon as it becomes something that creates a goal, even if it's outside the box and the forward committing the offence, the scales have tipped to make it harder to score then.
I thought Van Dijk did it last night. Defenders just in free kicks, when the ball's not going near them, defenders just falling on the floor more than they do. You know, sometimes, when they're a defender's running back towards his own goal or towards the byline, they sort of try and get touched and go down for a lazy free kick, an easy free kick. I've seen them starting to do that a little bit in set pieces.
Well, I think after handball, once you get that sorted out, the next big bone of contention is going to be players jumping for a header where their hands have to be. I mean, this was a fairly fussy ref anyway, who I think was fairly consistent with it, but Harry Kane kept getting penalised for things that I'm sure in the Premier League would never be called as fouls, where he jumps for a header, his hand touches the back of the defender in front of him. He's not shoving him, but there is a little bit of pressure, and he was giving that. Now, again, VAR will pick that up in a way that the human eye wouldn't. So that, I think, is going to become a big talking point. If that starts getting given as penalties, then...
Rubio says the attackers will no longer benefit from marginal offside calls in their favour. handing a defenders an advantage in long and through ball situations. Will this precipitate a return to old school wing play?
Well, I think what might precipitate a return to old school wing play is the fact that defenders can't just shove forwards out the way in the box as they mm-hmm. have been doing. So we saw in that Roma-Porto last 16 game in the Champions League, that late penalty that was given by VAR would never have been given otherwise. No way a referee could have seen it. Just a ball to the back post, the Porto player running in, and Florenzi, I think it was, shoved him. And it was given as a penalty, and that was something that... So that then means putting the ball in the box, creating contact, becomes something that's worth doing.
I wanted to mention that because you said that, yes, defenders can sort of buy cheaper free kicks now in a way, but they also can't do what defenders always do, which is kind of nudge the player just as if someone's shaping up to a cross, right, to put them off balance or whatever. So you can't really do that anymore either.
It depends if they get checked, though. And I don't know if they will necessarily. I mean, this one got checked, it was right at the back post, and it was kind of fairly obvious the guy had gone down just as he had a tap in. So... I don't know. I mean, it depends how many of these things.
I suspect the players will get very good at rolling around and shouting so that people can see on the screen that something might have happened, so that the check happens.
I think this is just going to mean that Luka Milivojevic is just going to win the Golden Boot. I think that's what it means.
A hot tip for the fantasy players next season.
Portugal 1, Netherlands 0. Portugal now the reigning European and Nations League champions. Portugal were way better than Holland last night, weren't they? I really thought, having watched both semi-finals, that Frankie de Jong would dictate this whole game. And actually, the Portuguese midfield were superb, I thought.
I thought he was too deep, Frankie de Jong. Sometimes he can do that, and you know, if he gets on the ball and he starts dictating play, great. But if you're doing that sort of near the centre-backs, you know, it's a problem. And I think going into the tournament, the Dutch front three was always going to be the sort of big question mark for them, and they haven't got anybody to play that number nine role. Memphis, you know, tries his best in that position, but I don't think he's suited to it. When Luke de Jong came on, he caused one or two problems, but he is, you know, limited in his ability. So I think Portugal dominated virtually the whole of that game, really. And I was quite pleased to see Portugal playing on the front foot. I think times under Fernando Santos, particularly when they won the Euros, it was defensive and dull, and there's no need for them to play in that manner. They've got so many expressive attacking talents. Even if João Félix didn't play to his best in this tournament, I think, you know, there's more to come from him. And Bernardo Silva, who won player of the tournament, was absolutely outstanding again.
Yeah, Miguel Delaney writing, Bernardo Silva now up there, must be among top 20 players in the world or so, becoming as important to Portugal as Ronaldo. I actually thought Bruno Fernandes was the best player yesterday. I thought he was, and Rafa Silva, when he came on, was brilliant as well.
I mean, Fernandes has got the sort of Lampards about him in the way that he shoots from the edge of the area just constantly, and you can see why he scored so many goals for Sporting this season as well. And I think his agent's already been in London trying to engineer a move.
Where to?
Well, there's been talk about sort of both North London clubs have shown an interest in him. Whether he ends up going somewhere bigger and better, not sure.
How good a Portugal side is this, Lars?
Well, they're good, and the exciting thing is that a lot of them are on the young side still, sort of mid-20s, if you go through them. Gage, Silva, you know, Fernandes, both the fullbacks. I mean, they have it's remarkable how for a small country they have another generation here now who you can completely imagine being within the mix to winning the next couple of big tournaments.
Yeah, and Holland, I guess. So Frankie de Jong, one young player of the tournament, which I think was decided before the game yesterday. David Moyes was the UEFA technical observer, said he continues to show improvement as a young player and his development in this tournament will help him to mature again. Had a good tournament for a young player. Very school report from Moyes, wasn't it?
But you think of where they were 2 years ago, the development in Dutch football has been extraordinary. And I guess it's partly off the back of this Ajax generation coming through, partly I think Koeman's management that... I've never quite worked him out as a manager, whether he's any good or not, but when he's good, his teams do play great football.
I just wonder if he needs to get Van der Beek into that team somewhere. I mean, I think it's difficult because they've kind of got De Bruyne and they've got De Jong and Wijnaldum, so that three kind of does work quite nicely together, but just feel like maybe needs to be a bit more goal threat from midfield if you're not going to get it.
That's the thing they're lacking a proper centre forward, aren't they? That Depay is erratic anyway, and I don't think he's a natural centre forward. I mean, Wijnaldum played pretty well as a false nine for Liverpool away in Barcelona. So whether that's an option, I don't know. But yeah, I would agree with you that possession wise, great, turning that into goals. They probably needed John Stones.
Great shame that Bas Dost retired at 28 because he's a, you know, he's perfect, isn't he?
There's still hope for Vincent Janssen. He's not past it just yet.
But I mean, you never know, do you?
But there is an element of improvisation from Coleman with this team, right? Because there's this great generation coming through, yeah. But you also have like the resurgent Ryan Babel in the team, and like you say, Dempai is not a centre forward at all. You just kind of put him there because you can't trust him to do any defensive work, and he can really hit a ball. So if you kind of have him loitering around the box, he might score a goal at some point. I mean, that's clearly, you know, as much as we talk about the Dutch resurgence, I think Koeman deserves a lot of credit for just making this work as a team at all, really.
Ian says, where does the panel estimate the Harry Maguire song would place if it was entered into the Eurovision Song Contest as the UK entry?
Well, second bottom if it's UK. If Serbia did it, or somebody who could get big votes off their Balkan neighbours, then it has a chance.
European qualifiers, Denmark 1, Republic of Ireland 1, two late goals, both headers.
Well, extraordinary, that Jorgensen slagging off Ireland going, oh yeah, we know what their threat is, Shane Duffy. Yeah, do something about it then. Don't just leave him dead, the ball in.
Too deep. I thought that depth.
They were far too deep.
That back line was way too, I mean, Duffy's headed that sort of near the 6-yard box. I mean, you can't defend that deep against that kind of threat.
I mean, Denmark should have won that game easily. They had a load of chances, but, you know, Ireland did what Ireland do, and fair play to them.
Well, a great interview with Christian Eriksen afterwards from the Irish journalist saying, do you think a draw was a fair result? No. Were you surprised how Ireland approached the game? No. Do you want to talk about your transfer? No. But they were they more attacking? Is this the, you know, Mick McCarthy is more exciting than Martin O'Neill?
Well, it was a 1-1 draw, not a 0-0 draw.
I'm clutching at straws, maybe.
I mean, it's a good result for them. I think on another day they might have lost that game 3 or 4-1. So it's a good result.
Mm, yeah, Eriksen did, as soon as he was asked about the transfer, he just walked straight off. You can imagine it was one of those ones where they said, no talk about the transfer, absolutely fine, throw it in, disappear. And he seems quite polite, Christian Eriksen, to do that. If he leaves Spurs, Eric Lamella will be the last man standing of the spree of signings they made with the Gareth Bale money. Can you remember the others?
Kapoue?
Correct.
Then Soldado.
Soldado.
Nasser Chadli was the last one.
Chadli, Chiriches, and Paulinho.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. There you go.
It's a good job Eriksen works out.
Isn't it?
They got some money back for some of them, you know.
I think Etienne Capoue's done well since, though, hasn't he? Yeah.
They got money back on Paulinho when he went. They got some money for Soldado, incredibly.
Mm. And Chadli scored that goal in the World Cup, didn't he? So, yeah, but they didn't all work out at Spurs. Croatia 2, Wales 1. Wales put out quite a young and inexperienced side. Dan James with his third cap. Connor Roberts, Harry Wilson, James Lawrence, Will Volks, Chris Meppham all started. None of them have reached double figures in appearances. Hot day as well.
Why was it being played in Osijek? I mean, I know there's reasons not to play it in Zagreb, political reasons, but why was it not in Split?
Explain the political reasons.
Just that there's huge ructions between the Croatian FA and Dinamo Zagreb fans. So
okay.
They're reluctant to take it to Maksimir because they would expect protests. But that stadium in Osijek was, it's like a Sabutia stadium. It was so flat and far away from the pitch.
It's like
sat on a stadium and sort of spread out.
Was there like a giant corner taker who was like five times bigger than the rest, and did someone kneel on Gareth Bale and he broke him and they glued him back together and he was a foot shorter?
Did you see that Gareth Bale throw?
It's
one of the best throw-ins I've ever seen. But I thought Giggs messed up his team completely. I would never have played Wilson through the middle and Bale out wide, and then I mean, Brooks not starting. I mean, I think Brooks has done enough in the Premier League this season to be in that. You create a spot for him, in my opinion, anyway. I wasn't sure about that team that he started with.
Dan James has completed his medical at Manchester United. A deal agreed in principle with both Swansea and the player. Seems like a quite sensible sort
of... Do you think? I bet you a coffee.
Right.
He does not get into double figures for league games started this season coming.
Ooh, let me have a think about this. So, okay, so I can't ask you any questions. It's a very direct bet, isn't it? I will take you up on that. For some reason, producer Jonathan wants me to get on with this. I don't know why. Scotland 2, Cyprus 1. They look like Cyprus were going to get a point from this game. So that is a key win, Lars, for Scotland, isn't it?
I guess it is. Well done.
Do you see Mark McGee's reaction?
No, tell me.
He was being asked about how the game was going. He was doing the Sky thing. And he sort of just breaks off and pauses and goes, "Ghoul." And that was it.
Nothing is better, though, than Steve McLaren doing
England, Iceland.
And he's going on and on about how we've steadied the ship and it's going to be totally fine.
He's got the big lad up front.
Exactly.
Awesome.
And then just suddenly this sort of existential crisis. Oh, no.
Tell us what's happened, Steve.
Northern Ireland won in Estonia.
I watched that one as well.
Oh, tell us all about it, Jonathan.
They were battering at the door, getting nowhere. Looked like they were getting... Yeah, not going to get the equaliser. And then suddenly got two goals in the space of 2 minutes with about 15, 20 minutes to go.
The Estonia
the first of which I think might have been offside, but I never saw a proper replay of it. So.
Oh, really? Did they not have VAR?
Well, apparently not. I was waiting for VAR to start, but there was no VAR. But it was...
Josh McGuinness, two late goals.
It was the shot from Washington that just clipped off McGuinness's thigh. And I think McGuinness was in an offside position. But as I said, I haven't seen a replay, so I'm not absolutely certain.
All right.
Estonian left-back is named Otto Pick, which is brilliant in Norway because Pick is a slightly vulgar word for the male reproductive organ.
Excellent news.
Yep.
Good.
Okay. So whenever they play, it's, it's lucky laughs all around. Yeah.
Lucky he's not Norwegian.
No, or hopefully we get drawn against them quite soon.
Well, Pinto is the Portuguese for penis, isn't it? And there were many Pintos. There have been many Pintos in the Portugal side.
Okay. Literally or figuratively?
I mean, you decide. But certainly literally. McGuinness's finish for second goal was a really nice little flicked finish outside of his right foot.
Big upset, France losing to Turkey, Mark.
France were dreadful. Sorry.
I'm fire away. Well, you're on heat at the moment.
Well, France were absolutely dreadful in that game.
Overconfident?
Just rubbish. Just looked so kind of dilatory. I mean, it was Pogba at his worst, and it seemed to have spread to everybody else. It was as bad a performance as I remember from a proper international side. Turkey really should have beaten them far more comfortably. Turkey couldn't quite believe how bad France were, and they couldn't quite kind of seize the opportunity because they were just sort of thinking, this isn't right.
And Opta chucked out a stat that Mbappe lost the ball 22 times. I mean, he's clearly... There's something going on there. You know, his dad seems to be trying to engineer a move out of Paris Saint-Germain. He's not happy with some of the wages that are being paid elsewhere. It was a very odd performance all over. I just wonder whether, having won the World Cup last summer, they know they're going to qualify for the Euros. It was like a D-mob sort of feeling just going throughout the squad, and they just couldn't wait to get on the holidays, maybe.
Where could Mbappe go?
Well, his dad... according to the Spanish press, is trying to get him a move to Real Madrid. You don't enjoy that, Lars?
I mean, I would enjoy it. I'm just saying, where are they getting the money, given the money they've already spent? And, you know, their master plan of selling Gareth Bale for $400 million doesn't seem to have come
up
yet.
Well, that's an issue for Ericsson as well, isn't it?
Yes.
There's not an obvious place for Ericsson to go, do you?
But it's more I've always felt that it would make sense if they can't get Pogba that they go towards Ericsson instead if they want someone who can pull the strings a bit in midfield and it'll be cheaper.
Has anyone had an agent who is their dad who's been good? Is Mbappe's dad his agent, or is he just trying to meddle?
Isn't it Hazard who doesn't quite have an agent, but his dad just kind of looks after things for him a little bit?
Okay.
I think that's accurate. You might want to cut that out because I'm not 100% sure, and it's not, a point.
I just can't think of anybody whose family has intervened in a good way to get them a transfer anywhere or not cause ructions at the club they're already at.
Rabiot's mum gets a lot of stick in the French newspapers for her meddling in Rabiot's career.
That's a sentence.
Where's he off to?
Well, that's a good point, because he's a free agent and nobody
good,
seems
good player
to want
as well,
him, and a very good player. Very odd
just
situation.
Before we depart the realm of international football,
there's plenty more to go.
On Turkey, then they're going to play Iceland next, and there's been a minor scandal because they've travelled to Iceland, and according to reports, they were held in the airport for something like 3 hours because of extra security, which they're not best pleased with. And then, to make it worse, in the media scrum afterwards, someone who looks like he's a reporter, could just be a guy, in the media scrum around Emre, a random person is sort of stuffed like a toilet brush in his face, along with all the microphones, what appears to be a toilet brush. And that really kicked off on Turkish Twitter. It's very disrespectful. I mean, one tweet here from a disgruntled Turk saying, "Another scandal in Iceland. An Icelandic alleged reporter handed out a brush to Emre. If you ask, Iceland is one of the most civilized countries in the world, yes? You're carrying a toilet brush in your pocket because you're a shithole. Bastards." So, thumbs down from Turkish Twitter to the Icelandics in general. I'm not looking at the pictures. It could be more like a dishwashing brush,
right,
rather than a toilet brush.
Because the toilet brush is one of the worst,
it's very insulting
items in the world,
I would
isn't
say.
It?
If it's used, yeah. If it's new, I wouldn't be that bothered.
No, but a used toilet brush is a sad thing.
Yeah.
Or actually, it's more the holder is a real container of... Producer Jonathan's saying, is this not, this is vital, this is pod gold, I would suggest.
Well, I mean, yeah, and it's been Turkey's presidential spokesman has, you know, condemned this behavior. This disrespectful treatment towards our national team in Iceland is not acceptable, and what is necessary will be done. An initiative has commenced. Our state and nation stand by our national team. So whether that means sort of dispatching the fleet to the waters of Iceland or something, I'm not quite sure, but lively stuff.
Well, thanks for that. Jonathan writes, Juan Mata's dad is his agent. And we all know Juan Mata's a lovely man.
Moving to Manchester United was a great idea. What a career move that was.
Spain won 4-1 in the Faroe Islands. Starting lineup contained just two Real Madrid players and one from Barcelona. And Santi Cazorla back in the Spanish midfield for the first time since 2015 is a lovely story, Mark, isn't it?
It is a lovely story. I think it maybe shows where Spain are at the moment, really.
Oh, I just take, you know, take the gloss off that romantic tale.
This is going to light up the mentions. But, I mean, it's a great story for Santi Cazorla and for everybody connected with Spanish football. And you mentioned that Juan Mata, you know, is a great guy. Cazorla seems to be similarly fantastic as a character. And for him to get his way back up to that Spanish national team level is incredible for him. I just found it a little bit odd, really, that we're moving towards 1 year before a European Championship, that there maybe aren't some sort of younger guys actually that you're looking around wondering if they can sort of play at that level. It's a team that needs some sort of freshness to it. And you mentioned there the lack of Real Madrid players. I think that was down to Luis Enrique resting a lot of them in preparation for what perceived as the much bigger test against Sweden. So you'll probably get the regulars back. But it's a great story. I just found it a little bit odd.
Jesus Navas scored his first goal for the national team since 2013.
But that's another strange one to put in there, isn't it, really? I mean, you know what Navas and Cazorla can do.
It was set up by Emilio Butragueño. Are you saying that's also a...
Past his best.
A great disappointment. Lars is showing us now a picture of the toilet brush. Yes, you're right, it's not a toilet brush.
I think that's a dishwashing brush.
Absolutely a dishwashing brush.
Still insulting. I mean, there could be all kinds of stuff in those dishes.
Yeah, or maybe it's like a toothbrush for trolls.
They don't have trolls in Iceland.
Are trolls bigger than Miami? How big is it?
Oh, trolls got big teeth, haven't they? They've got to be frightening.
Well, it's a giant.
They don't have trolls, aren't they? I mean, they've definitely got elves, haven't they? Because they.
I mean, they definitely have elves.
No, seriously, this is like.
Have you ever been to Iceland?
I've played cricket against the Iceland national team.
Okay. Were any of them elves?
No.
Okay.
No, but there were roads we were going along, and we'd suddenly kind of do a little diversion. And the road wouldn't be going straight in this apparently totally flat landscape. And we'd be told, yeah, it's because when they went to get planning permission, that's sort of a known elf hotspot. And so you have to go around it.
Right.
So, you know, I don't believe elves exist, but they believe elves exist to the extent that the route to their roads are dictated by elven hotspots.
Anyway, Clement...
Again, a spokesperson for the ruling party in Turkey has said that the authorities are responsible for this inhumane and diplomatically unacceptable behaviour. I mean, whether that was just the delay or the non-toilet brush incident, I'm not sure. This could become a real thing.
Lars, just to question, how many times are you going to come back to the brush story in the pod? I mean, is that it done, or will it smatter into part three?
I can see where this is going. I'll leave it here. So.
Okay, marvellous. The Faroes got their goal back at 2-0. That'd be exciting from a corner. Clement Olsen scored it, flicked on by Odmar Faro, which is a good name for someone from the Faroe Islands. And he looks very much like a man from the Faroe Islands. There, I've shown him.
See, he lives beyond the wall, I think we can safely say.
He does. Norway 2, Romania 2, Lars?
Yeah, the further adventures of Håvard Nordtveit, centre-half, is... it's sort of if you thought Chernobyl was a bit grim, you know. And I'm sorry. Listen, it's just it's frustrating because there's a lot to like about the progress that's been made. We were at a very, very low ebb a few years ago under Lagerbäck. Things have gotten quite a lot better, but the collapse here and then a collapse against Sweden before that is, you know, in a way, it was easier to take when we were just garbage, and now we're quite a lot better, but we've thrown away 4 points in two games at the start of the group, so
you'll be all right.
That's not great for our chances of progressing.
Montenegro 1, Kosovo 1. Jonathan, trouble behind the scenes in Montenegro.
Yes, Jovica Tomaković, the Montenegro manager, plus Filip Stojkovic and Mirko Ivanic, who both play for Zvezda and both are of Serb ethnicity. The three of them were warned that if they played against Kosovo, they were threatened with violence by Serb nationalists. All three refused to partake in the game, and Tumbaković has been sacked. I assume the two players have also been sacked.
The decision was because they were scared, basically, or
they
were politically threatened rather than they were trying to make a stand.
That's
right?
Certainly the impression, yeah, that they felt that they were unsafe and so refused to partake of the game.
God, that's depressing, isn't it?
Oh, it's horrendous, yeah. And I'm not sure the Montenegrin FA have... I mean, I guess they're in a difficult position, but I'm not sure acting as swiftly as that's necessarily the best idea. I mean, for a manager to refuse to turn up for a game, there's something pretty serious going on there, I think.
Have there been instances where teams are kept apart?
Well, Serbia and Kosovo are kept apart.
Right. So they should have done this as well, right? They should have kept...
Well,
I mean, I don't know where the line is because...
I mean, there is a long history of people of Serbian ethnicity playing for Montenegro. I mean, I don't know how far you can take that. You know, there's also a long history of people of Serbian ethnicity playing for Switzerland, for instance.
Sure.
I don't know. I mean, I think it's a really difficult issue. I think the whole Kosovo situation is really complicated and difficult.
So there's no sort of... There's no right...
There's definitely wrongs. It's definitely wrong to threaten violence to people who, fulfil an international footballing fixture.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a really difficult, complex issue. The whole issue of Kosovo, I'm not going to go into it because it is incredibly complex, and I suspect my view is out of step with a lot of people in Britain. But that's a thing that needs to be sorted politically and sort of exists in a grey area. These are the consequences of that.
Elsewhere, wins for Georgia, the Czech Republic, Ukraine, Sweden, Latvia 0, Israel 3. Aaron Zahavi scored all three, his second consecutive hat-trick for the national team. That's impressive, isn't it? And well done to Russia, who got 9 against San Marino. You can find all the results on the Guardian website. Moving on, absolutely tragic news, the death of Justin Edinburgh, completely shocking, age of just 49, had just taken Leighton Orient up. He suffered a cardiac arrest on the 3rd of June, passed away on Saturday. It leaves his wife, Kerry, children as well, Charlie and Sydney. Joby McEnough, Leighton Orient's captain, described him as a leader, a fantastic manager, truly great man. Going on to say, you helped to rebuild what was a broken club. You've been the driving force behind returning to where it belongs. That will be your legacy here. Gary Lineker said he was an excellent coach, terrific fullback, was a delight to share a dressing room with and have as a teammate. Darren Anderton, such sad news about Justin. It's not fair. One of the greatest guys you could ever wish to meet. When you were around him, you just laughed and smiled constantly. Rest in peace, mate. Mark, just incredibly sad news.
Yeah, I was in the Tottenham fan zone in Madrid on the Saturday before the Champions League final, and Justin Edinburgh was there with a number of other sort of Spurs legends, and Justin was on the mic starting some of the songs for the fans to sing back. Incredibly sad. I mean, I'm a Tottenham supporter. Justin Edinburgh, in my lifetime, I've seen Tottenham win 3 trophies, and Justin Edinburgh was the left back in 2 of those. He played in 91 FA Cup final, and then also at the end of the decade. He was in that League Cup team under George Graham, and just 100% every single game. And it is absolutely tragic loss. And you know what he's done at Leyton Orient in the last season. He's brought a club and sort of the community. He's brought that back together, and he was the real driving force behind that.
And a word here from Lenny Pidgley, one of, I mean, many tributes that came in. Lenny played for, was reserve keeper at Chelsea, played under Justin Edinburgh at Newport, and he wrote, "The summer 2013, I was seriously suffering from depression. The first day back to pre-season, I was a mess. I hadn't slept properly for 2 months. My mind was racing 24/7. Couldn't handle think of going back to football. I called Justin 2 hours after and asked to meet him. I broke down in tears, told him how I was feeling, expecting him to say, 'Man up,' or 'I'll speak to the board about wages,' but he put his arms around me and said, 'Don't worry about it, mate. I'll speak to the PFA, get you some help, and you take as long as you need to come back playing.' That meant so much to me and maybe helped me do something I can't comprehend thinking back now, but there's still managers out there now I've played for who don't give a shit about your well-being, just expect you to turn up and perform every game like a robot. That's what the fans don't see. It's what a good manager does to his players, making them want to play for him. Rest in peace, Justin Edinburgh." Obviously, all our thoughts go to his family and friends, and that'll do for part two. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So complete confirmation of Eden Hazard's move to Real Madrid. 88.5 million could rise to 130 million. A 5-year deal earning £400,000 a week. Carl says, "What does Wilson make of his leaving statement? Whether it's on tour in the US or at Sunderland on a Tuesday night, in Russia on a Thursday, or of course every game at the Bridge, you've always supported me."
I think they're the three superpowers of the 20th century, aren't they? USA, Russia and Sunderland. I haven't checked this, but from memory, I can remember him playing twice on a Tuesday night in Sunderland. He was brilliant in a 4-3 win for Chelsea. You're one of those performances you remember from an opposition player for being brilliant. And then he was rather less good coming off the bench when Sunderland beat him 2-1 in the League Cup quarter-final in 2013-14 when Key scored the very late winner in extra time.
Yes.
So both of them, you know, I appreciated both those performances.
Real Madrid are going to be fun, aren't they? Who else are they going to get?
Well, Pogba, Eriksen, depending on Mbappe, depending on what you believe. Of course, they've got problems in that Lars alluded to it earlier on, but you know, they need to get rid of players desperately, for financial fair play reasons. And you know, there has been talk that Mendy, that the left back from Lyon, may not happen now. They've requested a second medical for that one. But this is a team that needs to ship out not only Gareth Bale. There's about five or six sort of senior-ish players that will need to go, and that is it's a big problem, because Real Madrid is such an attractive club. You don't want to leave there unless
Steve Evans calls from Gillingham straight down there.
I think Bale is really one of the most fascinating transfer sagas of the summer, because we forget how good he was. Like, he was an unbelievable player a few years ago, but he's now, like, he's turning 30. He's had quite a lot of muscle injuries, which is, you know, alarm bells to a lot of club presidents and sporting directors, I expect. And he's on the sort of prohibitively high wages that no one seems to want to take on. Like, where does he go? But then in the sporting sense, he's so gifted, and there should be so many possibilities for him to have a sort of nice sort of last chapter of his career somewhere.
Is there a chance that he just doesn't really like football anymore? I'm sure I've heard this, that he just doesn't. He's sort of lost the love for it, and if you have, what a great way to try and become a professional golfer on $600,000 a week.
But that, to my mind, makes it even more pressing that it would be lovely that if he went somewhere we could rediscover that, somewhere where we could actually enjoy his football and his life, and
maybe he doesn't want to
rediscover
it.
Have a few more good years in his career.
Possible. Maurizio Sarri news. Fabrizio Romano in the paper over the weekend with an exclusive that Sarri's to join Juventus on a 3-year contract. They believe they will not have to pay a fee for him after Sarri's agent secured his release from Chelsea. Names in the frame for the Chelsea job: Allegri, Nuno Espirito Santo, Javi Gracia, Laurent Blanc, Frank Lampard. Gareth Southgate has ruled himself out, purely focused on the Euros. Out of those, who would you like to see there, Wilson?
Okay, who would I like to see there is Lampard, because I think it'll be fun.
Yeah.
Who do I think would do the best job is Allegri.
Okay.
I think Lampard would not do a good job there. And I quite enjoy watching the friends he appears to have in certain sections of the media falling over themselves to excuse his failings, and then...
Do you want to name names?
No.
Okay. Not one name?
Nope.
Okay. Coventry are going to ground share with Birmingham City next season after Sisu failed to negotiate a deal with the owners of the Rico, that's the rugby team Wasps. Talks broke down over Sisu's refusal to drop a complaint made to the European Commission in February over Coventry City Council's sale of the stadium to Wasps in 2014. Sisu argued the stadium, which was initially built for the football club, was undervalued at £21 million, and that Wasps should fork out another £27 million. St Andrews is 18 miles from the Rico. They've got somewhere to play, which is better than nowhere to play, Mark, but it's depressing to be playing your football not in the town that you are.
Absolutely, and I think the EFL have got a number of problems at the moment, and sorting out these owners. I mean, if you go back to what's happening at Bury as well, and also at Bolton, I feel like more needs to be done to stop these kind of people running football clubs and running them into the ground.
Now, Sean Harvey spoke about this, didn't he? And you are right, you know, the whether it's a fit and proper person's test or whatever test it is, there aren't enough good people with lots of money to buy the football clubs. And you're sort of thinking, if I want my club either owned by a bad rich person or not a person, you'd have to pick a bad rich person. Or is that naive?
I just feel like you could have a lesser football team. I mean, I'm sure the Coventry City fans would rather see lesser players on lesser money just playing, you know, somewhere in Coventry.
Yeah, no, it's a good point.
But the Rico's barely in Coventry itself. Yeah. So, like, the horrible stadium. I mean, I know it's not the point, but
no,
the Rico
right.
really is no loss.
Transfer rumours. Aaron Wan-Bissaka to Manchester United. They've bid £40 million, apparently. Palace want another £20 million. Would you pay £60 million, Lars, for Aaron Wan-Bissaka?
I mean, this is a lot, but, you know, if you want English players, that's what you end up paying. It's a supply and demand thing, I guess.
Ryan Sessegnon to Spurs. Apparently, he's told Fulham he won't be signing a new contract. Fulham want £45 million. Spurs want to pay about £20 million because Daniel Levy. That would be quite a shrewd signing, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think he needs to play in the Premier League. I think he's good enough to play in the Premier League. He sort of stagnated a bit this year, so a better structure around him. And, you know, he sort of fits the Tottenham profile. That, you know, he's young and bright and good on the ball and aggressive. And so, yeah, it seems to make sense.
Just a correction, I believe it's they want to bid 25. That's what they want to pay, not 20.
Yeah,
I'm
just
sure
on the,
he wants to pay 20, actually.
Yeah, just on the Wan-Bissaka thing, I guess I owe that a proper answer. I mean, I think, again, the interesting thing is that United are going younger after this sort of period in which they've sort of thrown ill-advised and massive contracts at sort of big names with sort of dubious value on the pitch. This is, again, is a young player they seem to be prepared to fork out a lot of money on. I think, wonder if that's Solskjaer's influence a little bit. He loves working with younger players. Or you wonder if they've just learned from their mistakes a little bit.
Sessegnon Wan-Bissaka will be playing in the under-21 Euros this month with England as football never ends. Decent squad. Tammy Abraham, Dominic Calvert-Lewin, Phil Foden, James Maddison. So should be fun to watch that if you have any time. Nigel Atkins leaving Hull after 18 months. He said in a statement, after much careful consideration, I decided that our futures are not aligned. It's a conscious uncoupling, isn't it, of Nigel Atkins and Hull City. He took charge in December 2017. They were 20th, led them to 18th and 13th placed finishes in his two seasons in charge. From David Burns, BBC commentator who covers Hull City, Atkins was desperate to stay at the club. I understand he was prepared to take a substantial pay cut to stay. It was not about the money. It was more about things like the resources he had at his disposal to enhance his squad and having a reasonable chance of progressing the club. Clearly, he feels he could not have taken the club forward with the offer he was made and taken what he has called the toughest decision of his career. Danny Cowley, front runner to replace him. We need to take, presumably the Cowleys together are the front runners. What are you shaking your head, Mark?
Well, I mean, you'd be absolutely mad to take that job. I know it's a jump up to the Championship, but it's, you know, the fan, there's a complete disconnect between fans and owner. There isn't any money to spend, which was alluded to there in that comment. Lincoln are a team on the up that he's gained two promotions with. I just think he need, you know, just show a little bit more patience and something better will eventually come your way. I mean, I expect them to go for a cheap option, really.
Andy says, if a player could inflate their body by blowing into their thumb, and the ball hits them in the chest, would that constitute using your arm to make your body unnaturally bigger and therefore be a penalty? Looney Tunes football is going to become a farce.
No.
Okay.
Well, it's not handball, is it? It's in the chest.
Anyway, look, that'll do for today. Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Lars.
Bye, Max.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Cheers.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.